history, and it's in the history books for sure, and it was a grand one. And so I'm at the airport, and I figured I was going to be running into somebody, but I was excited to run into my friend over here, Fred King. Hey, Fred.
Hey, Scott, I was happy for you to run into me, too, since I've been trying for two or three conventions now to pay you back a drink that I promised you. Just my way of saying thanks for the wonderful job you do with the podcast over the years and everything you give back to the community. We really appreciate it.
Wow, that makes me feel great, and this glass of scotch we're about to enjoy is going to be equally appreciated over here. I wanted to talk with you then about the... Oh, thank you. Here comes the scotch right now. Good, thank you. And that is about the convention, that it was great. And let's kind of go back, because we really haven't gone into any detail in talking with some of the people. But first of all, let me just say shlantje, I guess. That,
same answer, thank you.
Okay. Ah, that's good. That is good. So, the last night show, talking about Giant Thompson, you, when I first saw you, you were saying that was just such a great experience for the finale kind of a thing. What was your opinion on that?
Well, it's an act that has never gotten old. I've seen him many times, been to lectures, seen the full act, but it was special knowing that we were there for what at least was officially his retirement of the act. So, just a little magic moment there.
Right, and I thought it was pretty cool also. I was talking to Stan afterwards, who had said that having Lance and Penn and Teller there was a surprise. Johnny didn't even know that.
Oh, really? Well, yeah, I think his connection with them and the contributions he's made to everybody in the Las Vegas Magic community are very well known, but it was really great to see them make the effort to come out for that for that moment.
So the emotion that Johnny and Pam had was certainly true and honest, because that they were not expecting, and Stan was saying it was difficult backstage, you know, try to keep them apart so that way they couldn't see each other or whatever, you know. Plus everybody else, you know, keeping it secret from the people out front, so you can imagine. I imagine the logistics for this convention obviously had to be just completely crazy, because the technical standpoint of this, being in Las Vegas with, you know, great stage conditions and the technical side, you know, there were no glitches that I saw, really, of note, that were, you know, electronically. I thought the video enhancement was superb. You know, the sound was clear and everything for the shows.
And that's even more important these days, because we saw acts like, I believe his name was Ted Kim, that does very much a very synchronized audio-visual physical act, and so the synchronization requirements and the technical, you know, support for that is even more so than the old days, when all you had to worry about was making sure you had a spot on you. So.
Yeah, exactly, and he had a spot on him, but it had to be in a precise position. It's interesting you mentioned Ted Kim. I think he was from South Korea, and he was on last evening's show, and perhaps one of the most... Well, I say most unusual. Last night's show was very unusual. We'll talk about some of those in a moment. But about Ted Kim's act, that when the curtains opened and he was standing there next to some boxes that looked like presents, and he was gaily attired in very vibrant colors, you know, with a green tie and red shirt and everything. And then suddenly all of the colors just fell to the floor and it was just pure white. Then you realize it was a projection. And he stayed in that one place and he moved about a bit, you know, when he was pulling things out of the box. And the colors and things that changed, it was projected on his body. I was thinking about America's Got Talent, where there have been a couple people here of late, you know. And I remember Howard Stern had said, well, it was just right, not exactly perfect. But Ted Kim's was just perfect and spot on.
Spot on, no pun intended, right?
Yeah.
But the other thing that I thought was fascinating about it was, you know, we've seen so much how South Korea magicians have changed, primarily manipulation art, and we've seen entire evening shows of nothing but manipulators from South Korea. And here was, you know, something breaking the stereotype a little bit, doing a very different act.
Completely.
That was not heavy on manipulation, showed a lot of creativity, and I think that's probably healthy for South Korean magic in general, to break out of these stereotypes.
The stereotypes, exactly. However, I will say that was a nice conclusion to the show last night then, with Yu Ho Jin, who was doing a manipulation act.
Yeah, I believe that I've seen him before, but there was a moment or two in that, and look, we've seen fantastic manipulators before. Yeah. There was a moment or two in there where I just, sitting there by myself, said, no way, because I saw him, you know, we see the beautiful multiple back palm fan productions, but I saw him wiggle his fingers and twiddle his fingers and all this stuff and still produce, and I was agape. yeah. literally at a moment or two. So it was absolutely beautiful.
Well, they introduced him as being the world-class, I guess, first prize winner for manipulation, the world champion for manipulation, and he certainly proved that, which I agree with you, Fred, that it was interesting that he, the thing that I guess a lot of things impressed me, but I think what you're talking about is when he was producing fans of cards with colors, you know, they'd be green, and then he would drop them, and then what he had, and then he would, you know, have red cards, and then blue cards. But the point was, not one card was out of order.
You know, you've got to have the precision required to do that. It's one thing to, you know, when you produce a fan and you're a card or two off or something like
right.
that. I can imagine there's no room for error when you at all when you're doing that. And the most amazing, I mean, as if there is anything more amazing to say about it, we found out afterwards they announced that. That the young guy had been in recently in a car accident and had to arrive, I guess, in a wheelchair to the hotel and was in great pain and all that. And what a professional to get up there in front of, you know, what probably two acts, so it's probably 700 or 800 people at a time between the two shows. And deliver that kind of amazing show was, you know, makes you think.
It really does. And speaking of which, you know, a very unique act was the morning session. Or the opening session for me was Sir Patrick. You know, when Joni Spina was talking about this gentleman who had come out and she had worked with him and showed the video about how that, you know, he was always looking at his feet, very slow moving and everything, and about how that he had evolved. I mean, you talk about a caterpillar going to a butterfly. I mean, he changed into something completely different even than a butterfly. It was so funny. It was beautiful. And he got a standing ovation and a sustained standing ovation. But the story behind that, go ahead, explain.
It was just amazing because here was a guy that, I mean, he was trying to be something that he wasn't.
Yeah.
And Joni found the connection, found the link to the character that he was meant to be. And
he's kind of overweight, looks kind of like an Ab Dixon or Mike Caldwell kind of, you know.
Exactly. Guy. Not your stereotypical debonair, you know, tuxedo type thing. And yet they found a character that worked for him. And when you say there was a sustained standing ovation, it was a very, very sincere standing ovation. And as much for Joni and her contribution, because, I mean, she completely unlocked, like you say, this caterpillar.
Right.
And his dream, apparently, this is a guy, this is amazing. I mean, there's always the backstory.
Exactly.
We found out that after he did this, right before he did his revamped act, that not only is this the first time he performed in front of this kind of group, this is the first time this fella had even been on an airplane.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he looked to be in his mid, late 20s, early 30s, maybe something like that. And so you talk about somebody taking risks. I mean,
never been to Las Vegas, and they said, not only that, never even been on a plane.
Right. So for all of us out there who...
And I thought it was perfect because he had... He was very confident. He took the stage. You know, he engaged the audience. He smiled. He did, you know, everything perfectly. So it did not look like he had any butterflies. He was not, you know, worried or whatever. I thought the confidence that he showed, you know, it was just stellar.
It's hard to imagine that this, just by revamping his act, has not changed his life.
Oh, I think it would.
You know, I mean, in multiple aspects. And I understand, I don't have this on, you know, this is fourth hand at the party last night, but they, I guess one of his dreams is going to come true. That have actually booked him at the Magic Castle.
That's what I heard. So cool. I have not heard that. Yeah, because Joni was saying, Jack Goldfinger, if you're out there, you know, his dream is to work the Magic Castle, and I think he would go over very well there.
Well, Joni does such. I forget if it was at one of the at the Genie Bash or if it was at the last Magic Live. I was at possibly that, but she again did a before and after, and I want to say it was. The fella that's now performing with Murray.
Yeah, it's Chris Randall.
Yeah, Chris Randall.
Yeah, he did that at the last Magic Live.
That's what it was, yeah. And showed, in his case, he had a slightly more mature act to start with, but the subtleties of what a professional can point out to you in terms of timing and where to look and all that stuff, it's amazing. I think it's something for, you know, those of us that will never achieve those levels, still we can look and pick up pointers, and it gives people hope, too, that with the right direction, with the right idea, the right inspiration, you can take your act to the next level. So
I want to go back a little bit to last night's show then again, because one of the other really unique acts that was... what was his name? Just a minute. I've got it over here. Michael Carbonaro. Marco Carbonaro, that walked out with a bath towel wrapped around his waist and, you know, naked from the chest up and looked like he just got out of the shower. And so he kind of did a thing where he was putting on some shaving cream like he was looking into the mirror, and then proceeded to, you know, put more shaving cream around his shoulders and his stomach and all over his chest. Go ahead, talk about it.
And he basically, you know, to some slightly strange music, basically sculpted himself into a variety of different, he was a woman, he was a dragon, he was a devil, and yeah,
old man.
Yeah. I'd actually seen that before.
Oh, have you?
Yeah. This is before most people probably know him from TV, where he's done the Magic Clerk episodes. But, he is a very versatile performer. And I guess he does play the castle on occasion, too. So I've never had a chance to see him there. But, I think unique was the word last night. When you think about it, Scott, there wasn't an enormous... Okay, let's take away Yuho Jin at the end. The amount of actual magic in that show was somewhat limited, right? I mean, we had some grand illusion in the beginning.
Yeah, that's true.
But with Topaz, we got an awful lot of comedy. With Gaetan Blum, I mean, there's magic there. But what I'm saying, it was not your job. It was character-driven magic. Lots of comedy. Danny Cole did a couple of nice effects, but then we get Michael Carbonaro does the soap thing. I thought, and I hate to say this as a magician, but, you know, this is not the first convention I've gone to where a juggler just about stole the evening, or if not the whole convention. I thought that, Paul Ponce? Yeah. Was just...
From Germany, yeah.
Right. And we've all seen amazing jugglers and all that stuff, but this guy just lit up the whole room. You almost had to say who could follow him, but then again, Yuho Jin came out and did a very capable job of following him. But that was a real 1-2-3. I think the finale was awesome.
When people talk about jugglers, that's right. That they usually magicians are the variety in a regular variety show, but in a magic show, of course, the juggler is always the variety act. And what made his act unique in particular, I think, was his hat juggling. And, you know, he did a lot of other things, and some, you know, pin juggling that was speedy and everything, that it was very rapid and very entertaining. But whenever he started, you know, throwing these hats up into the air and then having them boomerang back and then walk down into the audience, and not only that, walk through...
Across the rows.
Yeah, excusing himself
audience.
From people's legs. They were moving from one row to the other.
And these were four or five hats in the air going easily 25 or 30 feet.
Like boomerang.
High and 25 or 30, you know, 45 degree angles.
I was thinking for him to throw that at that exact angle to know that he's going to take one more step to be able to grab that and get the next one going to be, oh my goodness.
Especially while crawling through people's knees in the row.
Tripping over purses or anything.
And the other thing, too, is you could see, even though he didn't really speak, he was very animated. He told a lot. You liked him because of his body language and his smile and a good-looking guy and all that stuff. So, again, there's always something to learn from any kind of act, however different it is from what you or I may do or whatever.
Right.
There's always something to learn, I think.
I thought Topaz did a great job as MC. You know, each one of his bits, it wasn't just introducing here's the next act, but he had something that was clever, unique, and creative and uniquely Topaz. He's one of my favorite magicians.
Yeah,
right?
He's great. Really, he did an excellent job MCing, and his own routine was great.
Right. Well, in the afternoon, there were three sessions, and that Jan Frisch was one of the session groups, and then we also had a session by Ian Rowland, and then Joshua Jay was doing Talk About Tricks.
Right. I went to the mentalism one. I had seen Ian Rowland in a Penguin online lecture on that, but I wanted to meet him live and see what he had to say, and that was very interesting. Lots of... self-deprecating comments about the title of it was Loving Mendelism, and I guess you really had to love Mendelism to be in there, because fairly small group, but I think everybody was very much into it. I noticed you in there, and he gave a nice tip of the hat to Banachek in one or two areas there. And then I also went to the Josh J presentation, which was a little bittersweet in a way that he announced that he was going to be ending his run on that after 12 years, but
and stepping down.
He and Andy Gladwin and others, you know, they taught some nice effects there, and they I really enjoyed it. It was a nice ending to his run there, I think.
I like that as well. And one of the things that he had talked about, that is Joshua, was his Hitchcock routine, which was something that he has never shared in print. I've seen him lecture on this, of course, as you have, Fritz, in the past, but it's never, it's kind of like, okay, watch it, remember it, I'm not going to put it in print.
One of the first conventions I went to, as I've gotten back into magic in recent years, was Josh A., and I was actually one of the spectators for his Hitchcock.
Oh.
And that trick has stayed in my mind.
Yeah.
Like I said, we've all seen card tricks, we've seen tournament store, everything. That one has stuck in my mind. And so when he said he was going to show that, all that, that was a little bit of a special moment.
Right.
I thought that was always a really, really
and
great,
you know,
effect.
Don't let me put words in your mouth. Well, maybe you should let me put words in your mouth. But I think that what makes something like this stick with you is the storyline. It is something that makes you feel, and, you know, I do a, an effect that is using a clue game. And whenever I talk about Clue, you know, it immediately conjures up images. People have played Clue, you know, board games, and so they remember that. And so the same thing with Hitchcock. When he starts to talk about the movies, he can relate to what he's talking about. And so there is an emotional connection in movies because we, you know, have that natural connection, you know, over the years, remember our childhood or when we have seen this movie or that. And so, and then the way that he plays it, that the, so it's not just the mechanics of it, which are very brilliant, by the way, but also the storyline, the presentation, and the fact that he's finally put this all in print as part of the free notes that we get,
right,
you know, from this convention.
And that's something to point out. Like I say, a lot of different conventions have their strong points or their particular things, and one of the nice things that Stan has done, at least in the couple of Magic Lives I've been at, is to have some very thorough notes that are handed out at the end so that you can concentrate on really enjoying and learning and asking questions and not on trying to write things down frantically,
right.
And all that can take away. You walk away and you can't read your notes anyway. At least I can't read mine, so that's really helpful. You know, Josh Jay is just always, I think, is so many people's favorite. That guy is just such a quadruple threat. I mean, he's very creative and imaginative,
right,
as given by the kind of pattern lines, the Hitchcock story,
right,
all that. He's just so likable.
Mm-hmm.
He's technically, you know,
more than proficient.
Yeah, proficient. He's a very sharing kind of guy. One of the things I love about him is his love for books.
Yeah.
Now, one of my stupid things that I did here, you know, we go to conventions, we spend money. I'm proud of myself that I didn't buy my first DVD until the third day. But boy, did I buy books. I am an idiot, and I had to go buy an extra bag just to get them home.
Well, tell us what kind of books what you
bought. Well, I bought John Caveney's new 2-volume release, Wonders, and then history lecture book. It's a 2-volume one. One is all his magic that he's done over the years,
yeah.
And then the other is he, you know, the Magic History Conference.
Yeah.
He's usually done a presentation, resurrected an old trick,
right,
and
right,
talked,
right,
about how he's done that. So that history aspect always phases me. I picked up Gayton Bloom's new 2-volume set.
Which includes all of his lecture notes he's ever published over the years.
Yeah. Right. And
did you get Mike Caveney's book?
Pardon me?
Did you get Mike Caveney's
I got
book also?
That's what I'm saying. Which one?
Oh, Mike Caveney.
Yeah, I got Mike Caveney's
as well.
Volume.
Yeah.
And that's, and
as well.
And I picked up a bucket load of Magic back issues, which again should have my head examined. And I still had Marshall at H&R Books.
He's going to ship
me a couple of things.
Okay.
So boy, I was pulling stuff out of my bag to get it down to 51 pounds, you know, at the check-in. So I'm proud of the fact that most of my money was spent on books rather than stuff for the junk drawer. But there's a little bit for that in there, too.
Well, when you talk about that, Joshua has always had an appreciation for books. You know, I've known him since he was in high school, way back when. And I know that he always had that passion, and that was what he was reading. Of course, that was kind of before, not about the time videos were coming out, but anyhow, yeah, and I also know that he and Andy Gladwin, of course, with Vanishing Ink, that they do have media downloads and DVDs and things that they promote and sell then as well. But they also publish a lot of books. And so I, you know, will applaud anybody who continues to keep publishing alive, you know, in the hard copies, certainly. But speaking of Magic Magazine and back issues, don't forget you can always get that on the iPad. Well, at least some of the, you know, last couple of years, you know,
right,
of issues.
Right, but some of the back issues, and it's like I say, there's some of my favorites in there, and it's, reading is just, it's a good augmentation. There's so much available audio-wise these days. I ran into Sandy Marshall again.
Yes.
I talked with him at length, him and Pedro from Magic Inc.
He was with Magic Inc.
And
yes.
At the Genie Bash back in October, we had a wonderful conversation. I picked up the audio book of his version. Now, it doesn't have the pictures, but I tell you, if you know Sandy, the way he tells the story and his beautiful voice and all that stuff, I think that there's a lot to be said for listening to the audio version. And again, with podcasts, all that. But there's so much stuff in books. And like they say, if you want to hide something, they say print it.
Yeah, bury it in books.
And if you want to find a new trick, go back and look at it in a book. And, there is a lot to be said for books in the way they just stimulate you with an idea that you can then turn into your own. I've never been one that's been driven by the presentation I see in the DVD. When I see a presentation on a DVD, if I want to do that, I immediately want to do it some way differently. But I know that a lot of people kind of get drawn into doing it very much like it's presented. But at least with books, you never have that problem.
Right. Well, let me point out something that you probably haven't heard, because I know you haven't listened probably to the podcast earlier that I've uploaded this week. But my first chat out of the shoot was with Marvin Roy, and he was announcing that he is doing an audiobook of his
Mr.
Electric Unplugged.
That would be awesome.
It's going to be like an 18-hour thing. He said that Mike Caveney is going to be publishing that as well. And he'd set up a studio in his home, in Marvin's home, apparently, in order to record this as he goes through and reads the book, basically. So it's in his words. And hopefully, he said that may be out by Christmas.
Oh, that'd be something to look forward to. He's an amazingly gracious man. And like I say, that's... that's why what you do is so important, and what Dodd
Vickers
did before he got tied up and things like that. It's preserving the history of magic. I mean, it's and you hope that some of our older folks are going to be around for a long, long time. But still, I'm sure in the back of your mind, you go, gosh, I really should go interview so and so and all that. So I know you make the effort, and like I say, it's valuable both for the historical record and just those of us that enjoy history. The Ricky Jay, what'd you think of the Ricky Jay movie?
Good question. Thanks for asking. I enjoyed that a lot. And that at first I was thinking that it might have most interest, of course, for magicians. And when Michael Weber did that interview with the Edelstein, the producer, that he was saying, yes, I understand that our core audience will obviously be magicians, but it is a documentary, and there are a lot of people who just like documentary films in general, regardless of whatever it happens to be, because they're always on a specific subject. And I had a chat with John Stetson and Tim Felix and Peter Samuelson following the movie, asking their opinion, since they know Ricky personally. And so they were saying that it was interesting that Ricky had released some things on video that he didn't ever like to talk about, particularly his past, when he was a child and leaving home and the problem, I guess the non-rapport he had with his parents and whatnot. Overall, I just thought it was a wonderful movie. It had a nice ending to it, because that when he was talking about his family and some problems, he never had any regrets, obviously, about that. But it just talked about someone's passion and what he has done with that, and giving background about someone who is not only important for us in our magic community for what that he has done, but also being a movie star, being a celebrity, that a lot of people I think would be interested in knowing him and behind the scenes kind of a thing about him. Independent films are really don't make a lot of money, if they ever turn a profit at all. And so I think this has to be one of those things that was done out of love. That was one of the questions that begged to be answered. I was curious to know whether or not that they expect to actually turn a profit on this, because it was a very high quality film.
Oh, yeah. And 15 years in the making, so there was a lot of love there. I hear a few wives, I think, of magicians walking out going, oh, that was a little bit too long, whatever, but I loved it. I mean, and the thing that I really appreciated, too, besides the insights into Ricky, were the... you know, everybody is, we've seen documentaries, we've all read the books about the great magicians up through the, you know, 26, 28, 1930,
right?
The Thurstons and the Kellers and Houdini and all that. And we all know since the age of video, from Mark Wilson on and the professor and all that, we have enough, we know that, we feel like we know those people. But in between there, you know, in the 40s and 50s, 60s, the Max, you know, to some degree, the Max Bellinis, the Larry Jennings,
Cardini.
The Cardini and Sly, you know, we've got some of Sly Dini, but there were, I felt that it sort of made Al Baker and Al Flosso and all that, a lot of people that people may have heard of but haven't really seen them. I thought it kind of bridged the gap a little bit between,
right,
you know, the 70s and 80s when Ricky came in and the Houdini and Thurston era, you know, sort of that gap that maybe has been neglected, but there was obviously a lot of good work and a lot of innovative stuff came out of that period, so I enjoyed that part.
Yeah, I think it was interesting that he talked about his mentors and people who were among the general public or unknown, particularly in today's society. I mean, nobody, back then people may have known who Max Bellini was, but they didn't have social media, didn't have, you know, any way of having something go viral so people knew internationally about certain people. And Guy Vernon was always, you know, kind of underground, you know, such that he, I mean, he was, you know, the New York card expert and was known in certain circles, but he didn't have notoriety, certainly, that celebrities do today.
Right.
And so the fact that he is bringing these people out as being mentors of his and people who have influenced his life, you know, give new life to history and some of these older people, I think it's important that people remember and know who they are.
Right.
Not just the magicians, but in the general public as well.
So things like the film screening, we talked about the innovative nature of the show and all that. I think that in a microcosm, that kind of sums up what makes Magic Live different from... I'm actually kind of overloaded on Magic. I did a poor planning job here. I signed up for IBM Phoenix a long time ago.
Yeah.
And then again 9 or 10 months ago for Magic Live. I figured they were 6 weeks apart. I could handle that. Then I live in Southern California, so then I learned way too late that PCAM was right down the street in Burbank, so I had to go for that. So
sure.
I'm taking a break from Magic, but what a great way to end a Magic marathon was with Magic Live, because, you know, it kind of combines multimedia, you know, it brings, I think, a step ahead of creativity over most other conventions. Many of the lectures are more like TED Talks.
Yes.
They had a focus session on writing for Magic or something
scripting,
like that.
Right.
Scripting, right? With
Larry
Jason
Whitmore
Bloom and
David Siegel.
Larry Whitmore. And they didn't really talk that much about that. They just talked, you know, they talked about fascinating things, and I don't even care what they talked about. It was an enjoyable hour.
Right.
It's not they're trying to pound certain points into you or teach you a trick or whatever. They're things that you'll take away, things to think about, and I can't wait for the next one. So
on Twitter, someone had said, "I've never learned so much magic in one time, but haven't learned one trick yet."
I think that kind of brings it down. So it's, you know, the old style conventions, they're great in their way and a good way to see friends, all that stuff. But you know, if somebody hasn't been to a Magic Live before, I can't recommend it enough. You will definitely see some things that are different. The people are amazingly friendly. Stan and company set it up to the theme this year was friendship, and I made some new friends and reconnected with a few others, so can't really recommend it. And everybody was here. I mean, Chris Angel.
Yep. I saw Siegfried, of course, Penn and Teller, and Lance Burton, and Matt King. I mean, you name anybody who's working
anybody
on this
that was here. It was amazing. You know, Jeff McBride obviously is in town, all right. That. But it really is, I think, a labor of love. And if I can just share one quick story with you here, I was perfect situation. It was like midnight or whatever, and I was coming down from my room and all that to get in the elevator, and by myself, one other person in the elevator, and look over at David Blaine. So just said, "Hi, David," and He said hi, and we just talked about a lecture and all that sort of stuff. You know, it was just, and I'm nobody, just an amateur, an enthusiast, all that. But we were able to just talk with two people for a couple of minutes in a mutual way, as two people that just. If I can share my other David Blaine story with you before we wind up here was, and I just want to mention this because I think it was during your week at the Magic Castle, you were talking to Howard Hamburg,
right?
And we're talking about influences on magic, and I think somehow David's name came up, and Howard just rose right to the point and said, you know, that he is just a really nice guy, and I've had a chance to talk to him and all that stuff. And again, a lot of times we think we know people from the videos they do and all that, and obviously David's early work was very sort of quiet and standoffish, and you didn't feel you really made a connection with him. Well, a year or two ago, I was down at MagicCon in San Diego, Dan and Dave's little convention they do, which again is much more of a TED Talk type thing.
Yeah.
And they didn't have much of a dealer room. It was there was a book dealer there, and I think Kaufman was there, and a few
Andy
other people.
Greger, maybe.
Yeah, it was Andy. Andy was there, and it wasn't much going on, and it was in between lectures, so nobody much in there, and I wandered in there, and I look over, and there's David Blaine, standing there with a ball cap, kind of looking at a book or something like that.
Right.
So I waited for a moment, and I just kind of walked over, and I like to have magicians occasionally sign a card for me or whatever. A little intrusive, but I think they appreciate the,
recognition.
And that you care enough to ask politely and with respect and all that. So I said, David, would you mind sign a card for me? And he said, oh, sure, no problem. So he gave him a pen. I had like a four of diamonds. I used to keep a few loose cards in my pocket or whatever. So he signed the card, gave it back to me with his, his DB logo and all that. Real nice, all that stuff. And then he looked down at my name and he said, Fred King. King. I've got to sign a king for you. Do you have a king? And I said, I didn't. I said, I'm not playing with a full deck, and most people know that about me, but I only had a couple cards. But hey, this is great. Thanks so much for this. No. I got to sign a king for you. So he puts his books down, and he's like searching his pockets and looking in his thing. And it's blowing me away. And he's looking through. He spends like a minute and a half, and he finally finds one of his own David Blaine cards with the King of Spades and his own face on it.
Yeah.
And he says, now this has got my own personal email and all that stuff, so I know you won't put it on eBay and all that stuff, but I got to sign this for it. So he signed this special. But the guy spent 3.5 minutes... looking for, just because it was important for him, he thought this was something he wanted to do for a guy that, just a clown that walked up and said hi and all that. So that to me tells me, and if that doesn't epitomize, 90% of the magicians that I've run into over the year, even we amateurs, even the people that want to bees and all that, or will never bees, most of them are just so friendly. If you show the interest, if you show that you, you understand the history or the perspective, or you have a thought or whatever, most of them, if you don't catch them at the wrong moment or whatever, they are just more than willing to chat with you about some aspect, and that's really what sets our hobby or slash profession apart from just about any other art. So,
great story. Wow, that's wonderful. All right, well, that's kind of a wrap, folks, I think, of at least yesterday's events and some of the overall overarching ideas and things of what this whole convention was about, which, of course, was on friendship. And so I appreciate Fred's friendship. Thanks for the scotch. That was
very good. Welcome.
We just finished that just in time, as we start to wrap up for this epilogue of the convention. So thank you guys very much for listening. I appreciate each and every one of you for listening to The Magic Word. And thank you, Fred, also for your time.
Thank you.
So for now, from Las Vegas, this is Scotty out.